Oh, good afternoon. This is my Robert Bly vest. Well, as advertised last night, this afternoon I'll be telling some men's stories about men at midlife and the spiritual tasks that appear then. When I was looking at the fairy tales as I collected them, I came across a whole bunch about men at midlife that didn't put men in a very good light. So I would, oh, I don't like that one. Oh, I don't like that one. But then there was this huge pile that was there, so I had to look at them. But instead of talking about them, again, I'll just tell you two of them. What's interesting is that men's stories tend to be long, have a few characters, but long and complicated plots, whereas women's stories tend to have many characters and a shorter plot, interestingly enough. This is a story called The King and the Ghoul from India. Some of you may know it as The King and the Corpse. It's from India. There's also a version from Nepal and Mongolia. Long ago, there lived a great and powerful king. Every day, he would sit in his audience hall, receiving people who had petitions and cases and things to ask him about. Well, one day, a monk came to him, and without saying a word, gave him a beautiful fruit. The king thanked the monk and gave the fruit to his minister, and the minister threw it in the treasury room with all the other gifts. Well, once a week, every week, this monk would come and give the king a fruit, and this went on for quite a while. Then one day when the monk came and gave the fruit to the king, a monkey jumped into the king's lap as soon as the monk had left. Oh, a monk and a monkey. grabbed the fruit and started eating it, came to the pit and spit it out. And the king stared. It was a diamond. He immediately got his minister and said, "Where did you put the other fruit?" "Oh, in the treasury." So they ran and looked, and sure enough, in a corner was a pile of rotten fruit and glittering diamonds. The king couldn't believe what the monk had been giving him. So the next time the monk came, the king thanked him profusely for the gifts and asked if there was anything that he could do to help the monk, promised to do anything that was necessary. And the monk said, yes, he needed a brave and courageous and noble person to help with a sacred ritual he needed to conduct, and the king was the best person for this. So the king agreed to do this, and the monk asked him to come at midnight and such time at the cemetery. And the king thought, that's an odd place for a sacred ritual, but since he had promised to help, he said he would be there. Well, on the appointed night, he left the palace by himself, left all the guards and all his attendants and stuff, and walked a long way to the cemetery. And there he walked into the center of the cemetery, past the burning grounds, the cremation grounds. He could hear the whispers of voices and smell of burning flesh. It was pretty awful. And he was thinking, what have I got myself into? Well, he finally came to the monk and said, well, here I am. And the monk said, oh, you are truly brave and noble to keep your promise and come to this horrible place. I'm about to do a holy ritual to cleanse the area of evil, and for that I need you to get the corpse that's hanging on a tree across the cemetery. It's a criminal who was hanged just a few days ago. And the king looked and could just barely make out a tree. And so he said, well, okay, that sounds simple enough, and trudged across the cemetery, came to the tree where the man had been hanged and was still dangling there, climbed up the tree, cut it down, put the corpse on his back, and started back towards the monk. All of a sudden, the corpse spoke. Good evening, great king. Well, the king was horrified. He realized there was a ghoul that was inhabiting the body. And the ghoul said, oh, the way is long and boring, so I will tell you a story. It is a riddle. And if you know the answer and tell me, then I will take the body back to the tree. If you know the answer and don't say anything, your head will explode. Let's see. Oh, this is the first story. Once upon a time, there was a woman who had three suitors. She was such a beautiful woman, three men vied for her hand, and she couldn't decide. Unfortunately, she died before she made her decision. Well, the three men were heartbroken. The first one was so heartbroken, he left to wander the world, forsaking his village and everything. The second man gathered her bones up after the cremation and carried them wherever he went. And the third one just sat in the ashes where the woman had been cremated. Well, the first man who was wandering the world came across a holy man who knew the secret of resurrection. So he learned it and rushed back to the other two men and said, I know how to resurrect our dear beloved, but I need her bones and her ashes. So the man with the bones said, well, fortunately I kept all of them. And the man with the ashes said, fortunately I protected them. So they put them all together, and then the first man somehow made the beautiful woman come back. And now the girl said to the king, this is my question. Who should marry this woman? Any guesses?
The guy who wandered the world.
Why would you say that?
They found the secret of bringing her back.
If people are going to speak, we do have another microphone that we can carry around. So when...
if you raise your hand, I'll bring the microphone.
Well, the king thought and thought and thought, and then he said, well, the first one who knew the secret of resurrection gave life to her, and so he's like her father who gave life to the daughter. The second man who carried the bones around is like the son who takes care of his mother wherever he goes. But the third man is like a husband who stayed with the wife through thick or thin, no matter what. So he should marry the beautiful woman. The ghoul cackled, ha ha ha. And zoom, the corpse was gone, and there it was hanging back on the tree. Well, the king trudged all the way back, climbed up the tree, took the corpse down, put it on his back, and started off again. And the girl said, good evening, great king. Let me tell you another riddle. Once upon a time, there lived a man whose wife died, and he was so heartbroken, he left his house and abandoned all his business to wander the world, totally grief-stricken. Well, one day he came to the house of a noble man, and since he lived now by begging for food, he went up to the house, and the mistress of the house gave him a bowl of rice. So he went down to the river to wash his hands and put the bowl on the ground. Well, while he was washing up, a snake happened by, smelled the rice, went to eat some, and accidentally dripped a bunch of venom on the rice, and then slithered away. So the man ate the rice and became violently ill. Then he accused the mistress of the house of being responsible for this horrible thing that happened to him. He almost died. And since the nobleman was the head of the house, the nobleman was responsible too. So the ghoul asked the king, great king, who is responsible for this man's poisoning?
The man himself, he decided to eat the rice.
Well, the king thought and thought and thought. Then he said, no one is responsible. It was just bad fortune. The woman certainly didn't intend to poison him, and the nobleman wasn't around and didn't tell her to poison him, so it's just a bad event. Ha 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 ha. The girl laughed, and zoom, the corpse was gone. The king trudged back to the tree, climbed up, cut the corpse, brought it down, and started with it on his back to the monk. And the girl said, good evening, king. Let me tell you another riddle. Once upon a time, there was a terrible thief and criminal and murderer who was running around a city, and no matter what the police did, they couldn't catch him. So at last, the king of the city resolved to find this man and dressed himself as a thief and a criminal and started burglarizing the houses too, so that he would meet up with the other criminal. Well, they met up and befriended each other, and the bad criminal, the real criminal, invited the king home for dinner in this secret underground place. So the king went with him, and then the real criminal left to wash up, he said, and get the food ready. Well, the man's servant then came out and warned the king that this criminal was planning to behead him, so he better watch out. So the king took the advice, left immediately, and returned with all his troops, and they seized the criminal and took him to court, and he was condemned to die for his murders and pillage. Well, while he was on the way to the gallows, a beautiful woman saw him and fell in love with him. And she ran up to the king and asked him to spare the life of the criminal. And the king refused. So she said, if the king doesn't spare the life of the criminal, she would kill herself. But the king still refused. And the criminal laughed. He wept and then he laughed. And the girl said, and now, great king, tell me why he wept and then why he laughed. If you know the answer and don't say it, your head will explode.
He wept because the woman was going to lose her life, but he laughed because he would join her very soon after.
Zoom, you lose your corpse. The king answered pretty much similarly. He said, he wept because he was so moved by her generosity to offer to give up her life, and he laughed because he was about to die when a beautiful woman fell in love with him, and how ridiculous that situation was, or how ironic. And the girl laughed, ha 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 ha, and zoom, the corpse was gone. So all that night, the king went back and forth, getting the corpse, walking away, the girl would tell him a riddle, and then he'd lose the corpse, and this went on for hours and hours, and the king was getting pretty exhausted. But he had promised to deliver the corpse to the monk, so he kept at it. Then finally the girl came up with this riddle. I'll skip a lot of the riddles, because some of them have 50 of them, some of them 30, and they vary, but the beginning, first one and the last one are the same for all versions. And the girl said, well, let me see, how about this riddle? Once there was a king and his son the prince. The king was a widower, and the prince was a bachelor, hadn't married yet, and they went hunting in the forest. They came across a pair of footsteps, and with their skill as trackers, they deduced that this was the footsteps of a queen and a princess fleeing from their kingdom for some thing. How they deduced this, I don't know, but they did. They're very skillful. So they decided that when they found the queen and princess and rescued them, the king would marry the queen, and of course she'd be the one with the bigger feet, and the prince would marry the princess. She'd be the one with the small feet. Well, they tracked them down, and indeed it was the queen and her daughter, the princess, fleeing from a war which had destroyed their kingdom. The only problem was the queen had small feet, and the princess had big feet. But the two men kept to their agreement, so the king married the woman with the big feet, namely the princess, and the prince married the woman with the small feet, namely the queen. Then they went back home. In due time, each woman, the queen and the princess, had a baby boy. Now the girl said to the great king, tell me, how are the boys related to each other? You might need paper and pencil for this one. Well, you all got it right. That's what the king did. He said nothing. He couldn't figure it out. He went over and over in his mind as he was walking along, and he couldn't figure out what it was, so he didn't say anything. And at last, the girl said, I congratulate you, great king, for remaining silent when you don't know the answer, and for going back and forth through the cemetery all night. So I will tell you a secret. The man you are helping is not a holy sage, but an evil necromancer, and he plans to murder you and use your corpse and the other corpse so that he would win power over all the living and the dead. But if he is extremely powerful, but if you listen to my advice, you can defeat him. Well, the king was surprised at this revelation, so he listened to what the girl said. Then the king brought the corpse to the evil man, who then said, oh, you are indeed the most noble and strong and courageous man. So all I need now for you to do is to put the corpse up, sitting like it's an idol, and then fall down prostrate before it. And the ghoul had warned the king that this is exactly what the necromancer would ask, because he planned to behead the king as soon as he was defenseless. And so the king said, oh, I'll set the corpse up, like you said, but what is this falling prostrate? You know, I am a king. I have never, ever done that. Oh, you just fall on flat on your face and put your legs out. Oh, what? How do you do that? Can you show me? Oh, you dumb thing. The evil man thought, this is how you do it. And he fell prostrate. The king grabbed his sword and cut his head off. And immediately, all the many spirits and the god Shiva appeared and said, for your nobleness and courage, we grant you any wish you would want. Power over all the living and the dead, if you wish. And the king thought a while. You might think a while, what would you wish for? And finally the king said, I wish only that all people in the world will know these riddles from the Gruel because they have so much wisdom. And that's the reason why you now know the riddles. Any thoughts or reaction? The story is very similar to Dante's Divine Comedy, where Dante at midlife has to descend into hell, then purgatory, and witness all these horrifying things. Here the king has the same thing. He has to leave his palace, power, and prestige to go into the cemetery in the middle of the night. It's like a symbolic entrance to the underworld. And the king is doing it because he promised to do it. He's basically a good person. So the question is, why would he have to go through this horrible experience? And the answer is, because men just have to do this. It's not a moral thing, it's a developmental thing. Although actually, it's not just for men, it's specifically for people in power. So if there's a reigning queen who's been powerful all her life, then at midlife she has to go through something similar. Other stories show this. What's interesting is the monk comes and gives the king this fruit with a diamond in it, and he doesn't know that it's there for the longest time. Good question for you to think about is, what are the diamonds that have been given to you that you haven't known about? Well, when the king finds out about the diamonds, he thanks the monk and promises to help, and then gets this very strange request to go to the cemetery at night. Yes?
Tell us about the monkey.
Oh, the monkey. Well, the monkey is crucial, right? Because otherwise the king would probably have never found out about all the diamonds. So it's a little preview of what's about to come, that the monkey is kind of a trickster figure usually, and he's also a god in the Indian pantheon. So I think he reflects the chance or the trickster at work. Do you have anybody else have thoughts on the monkey?
It's the moral greed, the appetite for development.
It's the appetite and the greed that you see in a lot of the tricksters. Very often their behavior is motivated by hunger.
I'd just like to request, I got a number of requests after last night's plenary that people who ask questions, please speak into the microphone. So we did get a microphone available, so please don't be shy and speak into it so everyone hears what you're saying.
I'm confused about why it's the same person, the monk, who gives him these diamonds and then turns out to be the evil necromancer.
That's a very good question, and that's a theme throughout the story of deceit or deception, or the appearance is not the reality. Like the king thought, oh, this is just ordinary fruit, but there was something priceless in it. And then he thought, oh, this is a holy man. Turned out there was something rotten in this. It was this evil man. So there's always this deception, and the riddles continue that theme. Well, the king promised to do whatever the necromancer or the holy monk asked, and then found out about the cemetery job. Now, would you have taken that? And when the king finds out what the exact task is of getting this corpse from a criminal, I mean, this is getting more and more creepy, especially since the guy's been dead a few days. But he goes anyway, so he's really keeping his word. And nothing would have happened if he didn't. This is quite interesting about how perseverant he is. It's sort of like the king in the golden tree following the stream up to the golden tree where it gets more and more demonic and more hellish. Well, the king is getting in more and more into the underworld, carrying the corpse back and forth. Now, any thoughts about the riddles that the ghoul tells? The first one about the three suitors and the woman. Yes.
They're a little bit like Buddhist koans. There's no answer. I mean, there's no one right answer. You can have many reasons for making several different answers.
I think that's a good point. They are in many ways similar to the Jataka, the Buddhist teaching tales, but they're actually, like you said, have no real answer. And notice the girl said, if you know the answer and don't speak, your head will blow up. If you know the answer and tell me, I'll take the corpse. He didn't say, if you don't know, if you tell me the wrong answer. So presumably there was no wrong answer.
I'm struck by the fact that from roughly the age of 20 to 50, most women think that they can answer their men's problems and solve the difficulties and straighten them up. And from about that age on, it becomes clear that there's only one way that that can happen, and it's the slow, torturous revision again and again that has to go on within the warped, troubled male psyche.
And that brings up the point that it's the back and forth, the continued redoing. It's like, again, the golden tree that forms a branch that falls down and melts. It's like the king might think, oh, I finally got this riddle. Maybe this ghoul will let me go. But he doesn't. It turns out that each riddle has an important lesson. They're very symbolic. For example, the first one, and they show a progression. The first one is about the three suitors and who should marry the woman. And the king goes by a conventional reasoning, the roles of father, son, and husband, and answers that. And at the end of the story, there's this weird situation with the prince, the princess, the king, and the queen. And this cannot be answered by convention, because as we'll get to it, it's a pretty convoluted thing. And that's the general trend of these stories, is it's gradually dismantling the king's conventional thinking, or dismantling his logos. He presumably is used to solving problems as a king, so the ghoul is intent on stopping that. And it's only when he finally does and keeps quiet, like a Quaker, a good Quaker, that the ghoul reveals the secret. Any thoughts about the second riddle about the man who lost his wife and wandered in grief and ate the rice that was poisoned by the snake? No one wants to tackle the ghoul.
Something about assigning blame. The moral teachers are blame.
Did everybody get that? The issues of assigning blame, and the answer seems to be a line that recurs in the I Ching, no blame. And I think that's exactly the point. In stories about young people, there's always the good person and the bad person, and it's clear the bad person is responsible for the bad thing. And this riddle and the other ones in this story emphasize, well, you begin to realize sometimes bad things happen to good people, to quote the book. Or as the bumper sticker says, something happens. And I think it's introducing the king into the view, the tragic view, or the tragic insight, that there are some things you can't control, and it's a misfortune, and no one's to blame. And that's certainly a midlife kind of insight. Of course, young people can have that too. I mean, horrible things happen to them. Then the next riddle is very interesting, because it's about this criminal that nobody can catch until the king kind of befriends him, and then the servant warns the king. Notice that this is exactly the situation of the king in the cemetery, that he's trying to help this other guy, and the ghoul is trying to warn him. So the ghoul here reveals he's actually not a tormentor, he's actually a secret ally of the king, giving the king messages, metaphoric messages, which the king doesn't quite get yet. And I think that's an important symbol, that often the messages will come from a coded way, like through dreams or intuitions. Now, let's do a little exercise, since it is after lunch, time to sleep. If everyone would stand up. Thank you. then bend over because, and close your eyes because you have a corpse on your back. And picture yourself walking back and forth in the cemetery, answering the riddles and losing the corpse, getting the corpse, losing it, back and forth. And see what feelings or images come up. What does your body say? And then the crucial question is, yeah, you can stand up straight if it hurts your back. The crucial question is, where have you done this in your life? You can all sit down. Any comments, reactions? Yes.
I don't know if this comment is worth repeating. Is that the same as beating a dead horse?
Actually, that's a good comment, because how do you know when it's useless to continue, and how do you know when you're supposed to continue? The king continues when maybe he should have stopped. Maybe the difference is if you're carrying the horse, then you should continue.
I must say, after reading this story in your book, Beyond the Harrow, a couple of months ago, I've been thinking about this image of carrying corpses, and it seems to me that this is happening very much in my own life. A lot of old stuff, mainly mistakes and baggage that I seem to be carrying back and forth, and I think it's a very apt metaphor for what I'm experiencing.
And that's often a general theme in the story, the study of the Harvard students I mentioned, following them from before World War II to now. Many of them, when they were interviewed in college, didn't remember these traumatic things that occurred in their childhood, which the researchers knew because they had interviewed all the relatives and parents and everything. But in midlife, they started remembering them. It's like the ghoul or the dark side came back and they had to face it. Or like Solomon, the shopkeeper in Solomon's Advice having to face this horrifying man.
This wasn't a thought. This actually happened when I was bent over, and my image was very clear and was probably a lot like yours, of a bent over figure, all brown, and the corpse all brown. The whole picture was dark and brown, and I thought to myself, well, so what, naturally. And then suddenly there was a bright blue sky.
When you least expect it, something happens. Brown is the color of something that happens, doesn't it?
But isn't that what we've been taught, though, as males, that we shouldn't give up? When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Don't be a sissy. Don't give up. In the military, if you turned back when you were supposed to be going forward, there were terrible penalties associated with it. So in terms of that story and what happens to at least men, in my experience, is there's a great deal of conditioning and training to do that very thing, even though it becomes very futile at some time.
I guess where the king's change was when he stopped answering, when he knew he couldn't answer this riddle and didn't take a stab at it or guess. Yes.
The ghoul makes such an excellent symbol of the shadow that you really can't figure out what he's saying most of the time, and yet you have the energy to keep on going and going and dealing with it until finally, at some point, the answer becomes a non-answer and then it becomes clear. Again, it gets back to the Quan, where when you realize there isn't an answer, that's the answer.
When he gives up logos.
Yes.
Now, the story is very similar to Sisyphus, because the king goes back and forth, and it's basically Sisyphus's story. Sisyphus had the misfortune he didn't have a friendly ghoul hanging around, so he got stuck, or his is sort of a developmental arrest. Well, how about the last riddle? Anybody want to make comments about that, about the prince, the princess, the king, and the queen? It's sort of like those IQ tests. If your father's, uncle's, brother's, son's, sister's, wife's, husband.
I'm my own grandpa.
Well, I'm from Virginia, and I did that in my head right away. He's the grandson of the king and the great-nephew of the king.
So how are the two boys related? That was the girl's question.
They're second cousins. Once removed. They're first cousins once removed or second cousins. Or if you can't figure it out, it depends on whether they're raised together. If they're raised together, they're cousins. If they're not, they're connections.
I think that answer means that Susan has to keep carrying the corpse. Figuring out a series of things. And so to me, the corpse are all those problems that I've had that I thought I could figure out. But then when I figured something out, then there's just another one. And so getting rid of the corpse has to do with, in a way, understanding that the problems are transcendent and that there really is no solution.
I'm curious as to when the intensity of an issue becomes a corpse that we carry through our lives, and when, as you said earlier, do we persist and when do we slough it off? When does an issue become merely a footprint that is remaining in our life and that we move on from? And why do we hold on to some issues as burdens? And why are some only remembrances, past loves or whatever they may be?
This is interesting. The king voluntarily took on the corpse.
I see the corpse as the repetition of compulsion, that we continue to do the same thing over and over again until we learn our lesson, and then we stop.
So that means a therapist would be the ghoul? Asking those terrible questions. And it ends with the mother-father one.
I'm making a connection to something that came out of meeting for worship this morning, and back to what Mary said about not living authentically. And I have a request for Marcia. I think it's Marcia. Would you mind repeating what you spoke? Thank you. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. We ask ourselves, who am I to be talented, brilliant, beautiful, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. You were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within you. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we give other people permission to do the same. And as we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
I think the story conveys that, where the corpse eventually ends up as all this blessing and power for the king. Now, take the figure of the necromancer, and the question is, who or what is he in your life? Where have you faced the evil magician who wants to cut your head off?
I think it was the first psychiatrist I ever went to.
Really? All right. An abusive situation?
I turn that right back on myself and say I can be the evil magician and have been very many times, cut my own head off.
Very similar point. I've gotten very interested in the work of a Jungian analyst named Donald Kalshed, wrote a book called The Inner World of Trauma, and he talks about the dark side of the self, the way that it works, particularly in folks who've had a lot of trauma, but I think it operates in normal psyche as well, that there is a part of us that it dismembers us. It cuts us off from relationship out of a sort of misguided effort to protect us from further wounding.
Bless you. Actually, the story nicely illustrates that, because he says for kids who have terrible trauma, there's an archetypal protector that appears early in childhood to protect the child's true self. But as the child develops and the trauma is further away, that archetypal protector becomes the imprisoner, so that the kid can't enter the world. It's like the monk brought the jewels, the self that was preserved, and then was going to kill the king.
I've identified in my own journey a time when religion or religious practice became a barrier to me to growing spiritually. I had to break free of the conventions and all the things that were expected in order to go where I needed to go to become whole.
And the last issue to consider is, after the king cuts off the head of the evil magician, Shiva and the spirits appear and grant him any wish he wants, what would you ask for? I mean, would you ask for what the king asked for? He asked that all the stories that the riddle told him be known to everyone so that everyone could benefit from their wisdom. That's an extremely generous offer. But again, that's another major task for men in midlife, is the generativity issue of not just keeping gathering power, which is what the hero and the king do, but now giving it away.
I'm really struck by the difference between what the original monk offers and gives the king, and then what Shiva offers and gives the king, and the king's reaction in each instance of selling his soul in exchange for the diamonds. And it's not like he was offered the bargain. He offered his own, you know, I'll do anything for you. And then in the end, the way he is offered something and he accepts a much lesser gift.
Kind of a paradox.
I was interested in the fact that offered something that was beautiful, the fruit, that if he had accepted it in the good spirit of, you know, not only accepting diamonds and gold, but a piece of fruit as a gift, he would have gotten both things if he'd eaten the fruit all the time. He wouldn't have had to wait for the diamonds or learn later. But he let the fruit rot and just discarded it. And the other thing, in the graveyard, the decent bodies, he passed the place where they were cared for and destroyed or turned to ashes. But you needed the necromancer to take care of the criminal corpse. And it seemed like there's some definition there.
It's ironic that the king's gift or wish that he got from the Shiva was from carrying this horrible thing, the corpse. It's like in the mound of rotten fruit was the diamond, and something horrible is the treasure. Shall we take a brief, maybe 10-minute break and come back for a story, another story?